Hi, welcome to Crosstalk Podcast. We are the number one recovery podcast in the whole entire universe and beyond. I am here today with Marie. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, comment, tell us what you think. If you have any questions, connect with us. We'd love to help you. The whole point of this is to spread a message of recovery and really help people. So I'm here today with Marie, and I'm really excited to hear Marie's story. I do know Marie for some time now. And so Marie, welcome to Crosstalk.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
And so tell me a little bit about, you know, your story. How did you grow up? You know, tell us a little bit about the culmination of events in your life.
Well, I am a native Floridian. I was born in Miami. I was raised by my dad since I was five. You know, I come from a very loving home. He told me he loved me. He encouraged me. He taught me right from wrong. He, you know, tucked me in bed at night. I come from a really, you know, I didn't even know, you know, growing up as with him as a single father, I didn't even really know that there was anything like different about that. You know, I was raised, I think, just like anybody else. You know, when I was 4 years old, he put me in a little private Christian school that I went through from kindergarten till 12th grade. I had a lot of good times with him growing up. At 12 years old, him and I got involved in a sport called BMX, and that's a big part of my story, especially now that I'm a few years into sobriety. I didn't realize how much of a part of my life and my story that it was. So I got involved in that at 12, and that was something that him and I could do together.
So that looks like bicycle, just to be clear, yeah. Like if anybody doesn't know what BMX is, it's a bicycle brand, right?
It's bicycle motocross, so that's the style of racing that it was. It's a big part of my story, not necessarily like wins and losses type of thing, but experiences and fellowship and things like that that I realized, like I said, as I've gotten further into my sobriety.
Okay, cool.
So I got involved in that, and like I said, you know, my dad encouraged me to do that, and I went on to do some really good things in that sport. We lived in Homestead for a really long time. After Hurricane Andrew hit in 94, I think it was, we moved up to Jupiter. But I did all the things that I thought I was supposed to do. And, you know, back to the bike racing, I showed signs of being an alcoholic back then. I did that sport very alcoholically.
What would you say those signs entail? Just for people who don't really understand what we were just talking about actually before we started, kind of what alcoholic is to us.
It was obsessing over a certain behavior. And even though it was a very healthy thing I was doing, I obsessed over it in a very unhealthy way. Sure. If I wasn't riding my bike, I was cleaning my bike. If I wasn't racing, I was, you know, looking through magazines, anything that I could do to get better on that bike is what I did. I did that very alcoholically. It was all, everything was about it. Mm-hmm. So
wasn't that normal though for a competitive sports player though, to make it kind? I mean, maybe there is some balance that could have been had, right?
Yeah.
But usually when you're playing competitively, you know, I think it's a hard line between like passion and obsession.
Yeah. I mean, it probably was, I was probably dancing the line quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I did do it very alcoholically. And, you know, it was what drinking became to me. You know, that was my whole life for a very long time. And then towards the end of my drinking career, drinking became my life. It became everything that I obsessed about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did that. And then I did, you know, as I grew out of that sport, I just got older and retired. You know, during that time, I did all the things that I thought you were supposed to do. You know, I went to college, I got a job, I got the house, I got the car. You know, I did all the things that I thought you were supposed to do. And even drinking wasn't really a problem when I was doing the biking, but I still did it more than everybody else. But,
so growing up, did you drink in middle school? Like, when was the first drink? Like, when did that happen?
I think I didn't even really start drinking until 20 or 21.
Okay.
But I credit the bike racing with keeping me out of trouble, because if I did not, you know, do well in school, or if I was getting in trouble, I couldn't go to my competition. You know, I couldn't compete. And that's the thing I love the most. So I stayed out of trouble. And, you know, I was hanging with athletes. I was hanging with other common, you know, people that had a common interest. And so we weren't necessarily getting into trouble and doing things like that. So my 20s is probably when I started drinking. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I probably drank like everybody else, but more. It wasn't really a problem until until late, much later in life.
Okay, so you are biking, and then when or you know racing, I should say, when did you stop doing that?
I stopped doing that in, I think, 2001. So I did it for, you know, 16 or 17 years.
Okay.
I did it competitively. I was a professional at it. So I did it for quite a long time. And the drinking, I don't think it really even got bad, like, when I quit. But all that stuff that I did, you know, associated with that kind of went away. I just got away from all of it. And the drinking became more and more. And, you know, during that time, like I said, I went to college and all of those things. There were some indicators that there was a problem. I totaled a car and was drunk and didn't have any consequences from it. I used to work for a particular energy drink company driving their little car around and lost the car. And that was a result of being drunk and, you know, doing some stupid things. Very lucky that there's no consequences for either of those things.
And this is in college?
It was, some of that was after college.
Okay. Yeah.
So little things like that would happen, but I didn't really have any consequences. You know, for the energy drink thing, I got to quit, you know, a part-time job. For totaling my car, I didn't get hurt. I had to pay $500, like, for a sign that I destroyed. And, you know, I got a $15,000 check from the insurance company. So I kind of went about, you know, my life like, oh, well, that sucks, but, you know, it's not really a problem. So I went on like that for a really long time, you know, with no consequences and not thinking that life was bad or anything. I got a job in selling artificial grass, and that's a really cool industry. I really like that job. Some things happened with that, and I think that's one of the reasons when my drinking kind of really took off. Just some situations with the company and some people, and the way that it was structured changed. I was one of those people that would go to work, I would come home, I would exercise, and my drinking would start at like 7 o'clock at night, and I would do that till like 11 or 12 and repeat the cycle with, you know, with nothing happening.
Right.
And I did that for a really long time. But then through those things that happened, the 7 o'clock at night became 6 o'clock at night and 5 o'clock and 4 o'clock, you know, and I became that type of alcoholic that if I was awake, I was drinking, and I would have drank if I could have done it in my sleep. I'm not really good with like chronological events, but towards the end, that's all I did is, you know, every minute of every day was me drinking.
And was there ever any, you know, substances involved?
I had my fun with that kind of stuff, especially in college, but that was never
your thing.
No, I mean, I could do it and not have to do it again. And, you know, it's not like it is now with that kind of stuff. My friends and I would plan a Saturday, you know, we'd all get together and it would be this like event. Everybody would go home. And, you know, and in my group of friends, there probably was, but I didn't know it. You know, there wasn't any substance addiction that I knew about. We would just do it like on a Saturday and Sunday, feel bad all day and not, you know, not think about it again for a while. So substances are not really a big part of my story. And they definitely weren't, you know, in my 20s when I was racing, because there was drug tests and there was all kind of things like that. So that was never a part of it.
And what about in your personal life? Was there anything happening in your personal, like, do you think you could accredit anything to the progressiveness of the alcoholism, or just, you know, that it is a progressive disease? And
you know, I like the effects produced by alcohol.
So do I.
You know, in the beginning, it was just I needed more and more. And I think that nothing really happened, you know, nothing traumatic. The job situation, looking back, yeah, it sucked. It was stressful. But I don't know that that is the direct cause. But once it took over, once that, you know, I practice a program of, you know, I work a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the steps. I gave my will and my life over to the power. You know, I gave my will and my life over to the power of alcohol at some point. I don't know when that happened, but I know that it went along, you know, for a really long time where everything was okay. And then it seems like one day that there was nothing that was okay.
Yeah.
Everything was terrible.
I talk about that. It's like an invisible line and you don't really know when you cross it, yeah. But at some point you know you have, and you're just kind of like, okay, this is me now. You know, this is, it doesn't work anymore for having fun or whatever, it's like you need this thing, and it's like insidious. Makes your skin crawl.
It's crazy. And the more time that I have in sobriety, when I look back on that, it's even more insane. You know, when I first got sober, I'm like, oh, it wasn't that bad. You know, now that I look back at how unhappy I was, I don't remember a lot, because drinking for me turned me from a very social, happy person to a person that sat and drank alone at my house. Mm-hmm. You know, I had all these plans and of things that I wanted to do, and none of them got done. I would wake up every morning, today's going to be the day that I don't do this, and I would continue the insanity. So like I said, I practice a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way that I found that, I changed companies in the synthetic turf world, and a gentleman that I work for, he had about 15 years of sobriety at the time, and he said, hey, Marie, you want to go to lunch one day? And instead of taking me to lunch, he goes right by John Smith Subs, where it's on the right, and he turns left into this parking lot, and he parks in front of a door, and he says, look at that. And he said, do you know what that is? And I saw a triangle. And I did two things that day that I don't think I do very often. I cried and I shook, because I knew what it was. I didn't really know he knew. Now I know he knew, of course. Right. But it was like the gig is up. I mean, even though I didn't know that anything was going to be okay or what was going to happen, it was like this pressure that was on, you know, the weight of the world was on my shoulders, right? I was able to just be like, just breathe a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And I went into that meeting, and I heard people talk. I don't remember a lot about it, because it was a lot. But I heard people talk, and they were talking like I understood things. You know,
you were relating.
I was relating like a lot, because my impression of what AA was, or what people that worked any kind of program was way different than what I realized reality was. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say that worked, and it did for a little bit. But, you know, I had to go out and, they say, experiment more, and things had to get worse. Mm-hmm. For me, the things getting worse were, like I said, I, you know, self-isolated and drank at home. I had quite an extensive aluminum beer can collection, because that was my drink of choice. And I knew it was bad. And I was sober about 2 years, and my brother, who ended up cleaning up my house, sent me a video of how bad it was. And it was kind of like Hoarders meets Intervention.
Okay.
There was pathways of where I could walk, and the rest of the house was covered in stacks and stacks and stacks of beer cans.
Wow.
And out of everything out there, I don't know how I ended up on beer in cans, but I did. And that was where that took me.
It's funny how, you know, it seems like a common thread when I talk to people that we don't seem to throw away our containers. Like me too. Like the last few months, I was like collecting wine bottles, beer, this, everything. It was like surrounding me in a room, you know? And it's just funny, like, why don't we just take out the trash? Like, why? But
I would start to.
Yeah, you would. Okay. See that? You're better than I am.
So my dad was an alcoholic. He stopped 20 years ago on his own. Okay. But my dad was a very functioning alcoholic. He had his own business. He had, you know, he never missed a day of work. Really, really, you know, a functioning alcoholic. And I didn't realize till I got sober and started going through these things. I drank just like my dad did. He would work in the garage and things, and he would stack up his little beer cans. At the end of the day, he would take them to the trash and throw them out. Mm-hmm. I would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I would throw them out a long time. But then at some point, the 1 days that I would drink turned into 2 days and take them out. You know, at some point that stopped.
Right.
And there, you know, you could see on the video that my brother sent me where there's all this chaos and there's these black garbage bags. And I would try to take things out. I would start loading it up and I would just probably be sweaty and couldn't do it. And I would just leave them because I'd be like, there's too many. It would become daunting. Mm. And I remember I would buy the black trash bags because I could take them out. Nobody would know what was in them. So, you know, there was a whole method to the madness, apparently. But then my brother opens up the washer and dryer, and there's beer cans in there. They're in the microwave. They're in the dishwasher.
I have a friend who put them in suitcases. And I lived in New York City where we had a shoot, right? So no one would even, I mean, not that I cared. I was like that person that's loyal to the same liquor store because I wanted to be loyal to my liquor store. Other people are like, I was too embarrassed. So I would go from liquor store to liquor. No, not me. I was like, I need to be loyal to my liquor store. I mean, I was, you know, they would just look at me and I didn't think they would look, I never even fathomed that they were judging me. I was just like, whatever.
You know. I was loyal to about three of them.
Okay, yeah.
But then I would find myself, like, whatever time, the Walgreens was the closest to me. Mm-hmm. I forget what time they opened.
Walgreens sells liquor?
Well, they have a little one next door, I guess. But I would find myself sick, sitting in the parking lot, and just drinking for, like, hours because I couldn't leave. And then I would see people functioning about their normal day at 9 a.m., you know, coming out of there with a Diet Coke. I'm like, how the hell are they drinking a Diet Coke? It's 9 o'clock in the morning. Like, what are they doing? Why are they happy? Why are they smiling? They're going to work. Like, how are they doing that?
Right.
And here I am, like, in a miserable spot.
Yeah.
You know, if I went out with friends, I would cut it short and I would only drink a little bit because I had to go home so I could really drink. And it just was that cycle. I mean, I remember one time I went to Orlando to go to Disney with friends like we do every year. And I couldn't wait to leave there to drive all the way home so I could drink. Like, it's just insanity that we do.
Yeah. You can't even enjoy the moment.
It's sad because, you know, I would have had a good time. But, you know, the whole time I'm thinking, like, man, I got to leave at this time, you know. And just all the things that I did. Like,
there's no alcohol at Disney?
I think I had told them I wasn't drinking. Oh, I don't remember exactly, but I think I probably told them, oh, no, I'm sober for a little while.
Oh, that's good.
You know, there was never anything that happened with that group of friends or anything, but they knew that I could drink and I liked to drink, but they couldn't have fathomed that I was sitting at home in the mess that I was sitting in.
Right.
You know, from Facebook and outward appearances, everything was great.
Isn't that always the case?
Oh my God. My life looks so great on Facebook.
Yeah.
Now it looks great. It actually is, but...
Right. I mean, it's so funny because I always say, like, people are always doing things. I just want to sometimes, like, get into bed and everyone's always busy. And people are like, yeah, no, that's not really what they're doing.
Yeah, no,
you know? So it's so funny. But so tell me more about, you know, just how you were living. I guess no dinner parties.
Well, here's the thing. When my dad, we lived to Jupiter and then he had to downsize. The way Jupiter is, my neighborhood butted up to his new neighborhood by a fence. So instead, he would say, oh, I'm going to come over for this. I'm like, no, I'll just meet you at the fence. So for like a year, he didn't have to come over to my house. I would always make an excuse to go there. And then in my house, it started upstairs. So I could still have people over. They just couldn't go upstairs.
Okay.
You know, and I think it started in like the bedroom. Then you could see the progression. It was in my bedroom. It go to the spare bedroom. Then it was in one of my favorite spots was the stairs. Like the landing of the stairs.
Okay.
And I would sit there Indian style and probably play Candy Crush all day.
Oh my God, I did that too.
Yeah, like why?
I don't know. Candy Crush was the thing. I can't. It's funny because I did play it in early recovery, but now I don't play it anymore.
Now I played at the gym on the stairs to kill time. You know,
I play something else.
Yeah, but I'm sitting there Indian style. You know, I didn't have running water for a couple months, but where I lived, every day I could turn the faucet on for a little bit and either get a shower or whatever. Like. That is insanity.
Yeah.
Just living like that. When I think about it, I laugh about it because I deal with things with humor, but I can laugh about it because it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And, I mean, we have to laugh.
Yeah.
About
and
things.
I can't throw that video away. I can't delete that video because not only do I laugh about it and see how ridiculous it was, you know, I've shown that to other people and they're like, you know, that's crazy, but I've done some of the same things. And, you know, when I started going to AA and I shared about that particular thing, the meeting that I found that I liked, somebody came up to me afterwards and I had just shared something that was super personal and embarrassing. And he's like, hey, how much money did you get when they came to do the recycling? And I'm like, all right, these are my people. Like, you know, they can make a humorous situation out of something absolutely terrible, you know, terrible to me.
Right.
But, you know, I found a lot of relief in that, you know, it's people that when I talk about something like that I don't feel like, well, man, I got to hide that. I can laugh about it because people have been there. And even if they hadn't been exactly there, they've been somewhere where they can be like, oh, yeah, I've been there.
Yeah.
So it's that's been a really cool aspect about it.
For sure. I mean, I don't know. I think that it's so funny how like we think we're the only ones, and then we realize that so many other people either share a story similar or share in the pain of it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not the exact same story, but like they felt the same way or it was unmanageable in some other way. You know, my life was completely unmanageable. I had like, I think a whole pile of clothes in a bathtub, you know, that like it turned into a mountain. My mom was like, I threw them away. I was, well, gave them away or something, yeah. You know? And I was like, what? I was like, those were my clothes. She's like, no, I'm not going through your things. Like, you know, I donated them. I was like, oh my God, no, you know, but my life was so unmanageable. I couldn't do laundry. I couldn't do anything.
Yeah. I couldn't do anything. And then, you know, the way, like I said, I was in Jupiter and how I ended up in Del Rey is that my dad and I have been close. You know, he's the best dad in the world to me. We had a very good relationship. Every Sunday we would talk about football. And on one particular Sunday, I just didn't pick up the phone all day. Mm. And that's totally not normal, even though no matter what, I would pick up the phone because I knew if I could like get him, you know, just make him, you know, get rid of him and,
right.
And I'd have my whatever. He came over to check on me and found me in the doorway in a pool of blood. I had a seizure. I had bit my tongue really bad. He had to call, you know, he had to call 911. And the craziest part of that story for me is I think that, yeah, it sucked that he had to find me like that, but he hadn't seen my house. So not only did he have to call the ambulance for his daughter that he definitely didn't know drank like that, he had to go into my house and see what I was living in.
Oh, God, okay.
You know, and that's still terrible, you know. So I ended up in St. Mary's in West Palm for 4 days. And my brother, who's younger than me, but also one of us who had been to Del Rey and got treatment and worked in treatment, he picked me up from the hospital and he said, I got a place I want to take you. So my brother, who's also one of us, picked me up from the hospital and he said, I got a place I want to take you. Will you go? And I had been in St. Mary's for 4 days. They didn't tell me much of what was going on there. When I had the seizure, I bit my tongue on both sides. I couldn't really talk. I was very sick, not just as an alcoholic, but I was a very sick person. You know, I was bloated. I had hit my head. There was just a lot going on and I knew I wanted to get out of there and my brother could have taken me anywhere, but I said, yeah, whatever. So he brings me to Del Rey. He had gone to a treatment center. He got me scholarshiped into there and he put me in a halfway house. And I had lived alone for 10 years and suddenly here I am living in, you know, a halfway house with six other girls half my age.
Oh my God, I know that.
Yeah, I came in and he had packed some stuff. I had like one pair of underwear, you know, just one little trash bag or Publix bag. And my car had been repossessed, so we had to go to Orlando to get it.
So sorry, the treatment center you went to, that was, you didn't have to live in? It wasn't residential?
I guess they would have taken me residential, but my brother, for some reason, found where I went to halfway, and okay. I was able to do. I did their IOP and halfway IOP intense outpatient.
Okay, yeah, yeah, outpatient.
Yeah, so I did that.
You go a few times a week, and yeah, then also Monday through work
Thursday. Yeah, that's how I was working and all that stuff. But you know, I did all that. You know, and when he picked me up from, oh, sorry, in between there, I did go to detox. So he picked me up from the hospital. He took me to detox. I spent 2 weeks in detox.
Okay.
Spent Christmas in detox. Don't recommend it.
I spent Christmas in treatment.
Yeah.
You know.
If you can avoid that, I highly would recommend doing
yeah,
so.
Yeah, that wasn't fun.
Yeah, I remember calling and I couldn't talk and I'm on the phone. My dad's like, you don't sound happy. I'm like, I think I'm happy. Oh, it was bad. It was really bad.
Because you couldn't talk.
I couldn't eat. I lived on like Ensure shakes for 2 weeks. Yeah, that alone will keep me sober.
Yeah, yeah. It's those, I know.
Yep. So I did the detox and my brother once again picked me up. My brother did it because my dad's getting older. It just was, you know, and my brother knows what he's doing, you know, as far as that goes. And then he brought me to Del Rey after the detox. And as part of living in the halfway house was, I had to attend four outside meetings a week, and I had to work and I had to do the IOP, and it was a lot, you know, it was a lot from doing absolutely nothing except sitting home to drinking to having to have all these rules. It was a lot, but I'm so thankful and so grateful that the first meeting I walked into was a 7 a.m. at a place called Crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
and
in Delray Beach,
in Delray Beach, Florida. If you're ever, it's the best.
It's the recovery capital of America.
Yeah, we take all AAers, CAers. Yeah. We take all of them. But yeah. That place, when I walk into the doors of that building, whatever room, I don't care what room it is, you hear laughter. Mm. And I thought that, you know, my idea of sobriety, I thought that I was going to be this miserable person talking about my past and how terrible it was and all that I miss about it. And I heard these people laughing at each other. I saw these people that would come in at 7 o'clock in the morning and were genuinely interested and genuinely wanted to see each other succeed. And I didn't know it right away, but I felt something. And then, you know, after going back, after not knowing what I'm doing, walking in there having no clue what I'm doing, you know, because when I did AA the first time, I didn't participate in my own recovery. I didn't participate in anything. I would raise my hand every once in a while, but I didn't do what they suggested that I do.
Right.
Slowly, I started taking some suggestions. And
well, you bit your tongue off, so you're yeah. Like, maybe I don't know what I'm doing.
My shares would have not been very. You wouldn't have been able to tell what they were about. I probably wouldn't have laughed about it as much then, though. But I knew that there was something that those people had that I wanted.
Right.
Didn't necessarily know what it was. Knew that I didn't know what I was doing, but I know that I started showing up every day, and I got involved.
I did that same meeting and same, like it's funny, I arrived at treatment. It was the week of Thanksgiving after 8 days in detox. And I went to a meeting that night and it was like an NA meeting. And I just didn't like that it was a night meeting. I was, you know, I also wasn't focused. I wasn't. So someone said, oh, try the 7 a.m. meeting. I was like, I'm not a morning person. They're like, just try it. I was like, okay. And it was great. It's that same meeting you're talking about. So much laughter, all this hope, people laughing at each other. But also I looked around and I was like, there's life after this, you know? And for me, the biggest issue I had was I would sit on my little terrace. And at the time I smoked cigarettes still. And I was smoking like one cigarette after the other. And I was, you know, thinking, how am I going to live? What am I going to do? How am I going to wake up in the morning? How am I going to go to sleep at night? You know, like it was like how. And it's so funny to me now today how was I living, right? You know, I that wasn't a life, you know. It's kind of like I don't want that life back. I thought I wanted my life back, right? But really, I have a life that is way better, never could have imagined, you know, yeah. That I would have today.
Yeah, I thought, you know, like I said, I thought I wasn't going to be happy. And I thought I, you know, compared to what? Me sitting alone at my house playing Candy Crush and, you know, on the floor?
Right. Collecting
like,
beer cans.
What were my expectations, really?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So early recovery looked like, you know, intensive outpatient, which means like going to group therapy, yeah. Right? Multiple times a week.
Yeah.
Going to 12-step meetings, living in a halfway where I'm assuming you had to be accountable,
yeah.
Probably had a curfew,
yeah.
Maybe get drug tested.
Maybe.
You know, that type of stuff. And so it's a lot of like accountability and I guess rules or suggestions, however you want to say it. But now, what does it look like now? So like, what is life like for you now? Paint us a picture of, you know, how you've moved through that recovery through the years.
A lot of the things that I learned halfway, I've just relearned because I was pretty disciplined about some things, but relearning a lot of things and then being accountable again, because I wasn't accountable to anybody.
How long ago was this? How many years do you have clean?
Three and a half.
Three and a half.
So yeah, I'm coming up on December will be four. Everything goes as planned.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, so, you know, And now, it's crazy. Like, I'm not one of those people that's going to tell you my life's like wild, you know, better than my wildest dreams, because those involve like a yacht and some private island, you know. But you know what I have today is I can sleep at night. I have peace. I'm not in a constant state of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
I don't sit at my house all day. Sometimes like maybe once a week, but like I do stuff and I don't have to be doing things, you know. I talk about the BMX a lot because what I found in AA is fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And my little Christian school that I told you I went to, I always thought fellowship was God.
Mm.
I always thought that when you talked about fellowship, you talked about the church and God. And that was just me, you know, my wrong view of that mm-hmm. or my wrong understanding of that. What I found in AA is fellowship. And fellowship is basically just being with a group of people that you have a common interest with.
Right. Camaraderie.
Camaraderie. Yeah. Well, when I look back, that's what I had in my BMX. Mm-hmm. All people that had the same goal or in the same direction. You know, when we went to eat, we could talk about the same things. That's what I find in sobriety is the people that I have in my life now, we all have a common interest. Mm-hmm. And we all have an interest in seeing each other get better. You know, not only ourselves, but each other. This is the only thing I've ever been involved in my life where people genuinely want to see you get better.
I know, isn't it cool?
You know, it's not really like a team. You know, we're all one team. And it's really cool. You know, somebody gets up there and celebrates their 30 days, 60 days when we clap. We genuinely know because we got up there and got that, you know, that same chip where you had to go up there and, you know, humble yourself a little bit and start from the bottom. So, you know, they genuinely want to see you succeed. You know, I have a normal job. I work all week. I do a lot of fun things. In this program, I've met some amazing people. You're going to meet some of the best people that you've ever met in your life in recovery that are generous, that are kind.
I remember in early recovery, they were like, if you need a job, like, you know, fine. They're truly a group of people that, you know, want to help people, want to see people succeed. And I always say it's a place where, you know, you and I are not best friends, right? We don't hang out all the time, but I know I can call you anytime. And not only will you be there for me, but you'll talk to me, you'll probably say, let's go out to eat or let's go to a meeting or let's go do something, you know, and that happened to me actually at 3 years sober. And I talk about it, how, you know, I wanted to relapse. And I remember I called Janet, Cindy, all these people. And I was like, I don't know who this woman is. I couldn't even tell you if you put her in a lineup, what she looked like, but she answered the phone. She spoke to me and I didn't relapse that day. Yeah. You know, I didn't pick up because those women answer the phone. And that's what's so cool about this program. What you talk about, you know, is just it's deeper than friendship.
Yeah,
it's like
you learn how to be a better friend. You learn how to show up for people because people show up for you and they teach you these things, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what I learned in meetings. You know, I saw how people treat each other and I saw, you know, the joy they get from doing it and the joy they can bring other people.
Right.
And it's, you know, there's people that'll pick up the phone and, you know, do anything for you. And it's pretty crazy because, you know, there's bad eggs everywhere. Right. But most of these people want to help you without any strings attached.
Yeah.
And
of course, it's
really cool. You know, like I said, I get to do a lot of fun things. You know, I was at game one of the Panthers playoffs at Center Ice from somebody I know in the program, you know.
Awesome.
That is a pretty cool thing.
Right.
So, like, for me, sobriety looks a lot like that. It's a lot of fun things. I don't sit around, you know, and mope all the time. I have a lot of people that I get to do cool things with, you know.
Okay. And you said you also, from our pre-conversation, you also meditate.
I do meditate. That's probably in the last 6 to 8 months, that's been like a thing that I have started doing. It's really been cool. I started out with like 3 minutes. I'm up to 6 now. So
I'm a big advocate for meditation. I talk about it all the time. I'm like, I feel like it's my medication. I feel like it's my God. I feel like it's my everything. Yeah. I love meditating. I also started with 1 minute and the whole time I was like, oh, you know, like, what am I doing? But I also am going to throw you under the bus because you told me that you're being inducted to the Hall of Fame in Florida tell us about it. I don't want to say.
Yeah. So I was pretty good at it. So next weekend I'm going to get inducted into the BMX Hall of Fame in Florida. So that's pretty cool.
That is so cool.
I'm happy that, you know, my alcoholism did not ruin like that for me, but yeah, it's really cool. So I'm going to get to, but the thing with that is I'm going to get to see people that I haven't seen in like 20 years. Which is going to be cool.
And they never saw you as an alcoholic.
No, like I mean, they definitely knew you could drink and Marie could hold her liquor, but it definitely not picturing me in my house like I was. So it's going to be cool.
Of course.
And it wasn't till I hit the 2 year mark that I actually made kind of any like general posts on Facebook or anything. And I have lots of friends through, you know, still in that sport, just through Facebook and social media.
Okay.
And I made a post at 2 years, you know, and it was, hundreds of comments and hundreds of people like, oh, I didn't know, me too. I'm sober this many years. And it was a really cool thing.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that. And, I mean, yeah, it's so cool to find those people that you were like, of course.
I had no clue. You know, like, oh, that, no, didn't know about you.
All. Yeah. Right. And of course you would find people like that because there's so many of us.
Yeah. We're everywhere. Yeah,
we're everywhere. And, you know, for better or for worse, this is a huge problem across America, you know, and so many people suffer in silence. And I think, not to get so serious, but like the whole point of this podcast is to, you know, what's the word? You know, there's a stigma. We want to get rid of that stigma. Yeah. And have people understand that, like, yes, there's like the mental health issues, but then there's also this, which is like a disease. Some people don't do this because they want to. They do it because they need to. They have to. They feel this compulsion that's part of their genetic makeup. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you believe that, you know, I've seen it. It's true. And it's just amazing that there's a place for us to go and help each other.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought like I'd never go to a concert again or I'd never go to these things. And just last year I went to a concert at the West Palm Beach Amphitheater, whatever it's called now, you know, and I went with a group of like two sober friends. We met some more sober friends there. One little pod in like the lawn section. There's like 30 or 40,000 people there or something like mm-hmm. that. So we had our little group. Right behind that was another group of sober people that one of us knew each of them. So out of all these people, independently, there's two little towels, you know, spots where we're like sober people. So we're all over the place.
Yeah.
And it was cool because, you know, there's all this chaos going on and there's, you know, obviously drinking, smoking weed and all this stuff, but you're like, all right, you know, there's some of us here and we're everywhere. And that's kind of comforting to know too.
Yeah. And in early sobriety, you think you'll never be able to be around a glass of wine or never be able to be around a joint. Like, you know, and I have friends who are normies, you know, and I don't want them to not drink around me. I don't want them to not.
Right.
Please. Like if you can do it, I just can't, you know, like you know how to have a joint and go to work. I go to work and have a joint. You know what I mean? Like I can't go to work without a joint type of thing.
Now that doesn't mean that I'm not in Publix and the guy behind me is buying like one beer or six pack. And I'm like, what are you going to do with a six pack?
Right.
Like, is that going to get you to your car? Like, I still think.
Me
you know?
Too. This one.
But I pick up the phone and I call somebody and everything's fine. We laugh about it.
It's funny you say that because I, you know, I'm coming up on, it'll be 8 years.
Wow.
In a few months. Okay. And like, I can't believe that. But I think about things sometimes, but like, I really don't have these urges. And recently I was in like an hour and a half of like really bad traffic and it was hot and I arrived at my destination and I was annoyed. Like Florida drivers are annoying. And I got there and I've quit smoking too, right? All nicotine, all everything. And I see this guy and he is like in this beautiful glass, right? Red wine, not in one of those gross like bar glasses, like in one of those like at home glasses, you know, like the super nice ones, long stem and everything. And he's drinking red wine and he had a pack of cigarettes. And I just saw the red wine and the pack of cigarettes and I go, I want both of those right now. Like, I don't know what I wanted more. I think I wanted the cigarettes more than the wine actually. And of course, then the first thing I do is call someone and my sponsor. And then I called a friend, you know, and it went away after a minute. But like, I was like, oh, that's still there. Yeah. You know, it doesn't really go away. And whoever really says it does, I don't know. I don't know if you're being honest with yourself, but you know, it was the strongest I've ever felt it in 8 years.
Our disease tells us it's okay, you know. Like, yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Oh, of course. And then I'm rationalizing. I'm like, maybe now that I believe in God, like I think I could have it. Or maybe now that I'm like spiritual. Or maybe now that I know how to cope with things better.
Yeah.
I mean, like a million and one thoughts, and then like I can't do that.
Yeah. For me, it was a good day.
Yeah.
I wasn't working in my current job. I was working another job and we worked on a Saturday, which we never do, but it was like extra and, you know, it was overtime and we built some things and it was at a bicycle thing. And I was driving home. I'm like, man, you know, it would really be nice. 'Cause I felt like I worked hard. I just, you know, So it was a good day that, you know, it tells me it's okay on a good day.
Right. So I mean, that's it, right? We want to drink when we're happy. We want to drink when we're sad.
Yeah, it's not fair.
But it gets better, I think. And, you know, those are few and far between those days.
Yeah.
Because really, I never think about it. It's really incredible how little it comes. I mean, we talk about it. I do this podcast. I go to meetings. You know, and even when I'm not going to meetings and I'm just like, I'm still in the community, I'm at my treatment center volunteering or working with women or, you know, whatever that may look like. And, you know, it's funny how my first thought on bad days is not normally that. I mean, that's a one time and like, oh, I don't even know, you know, the percentage is so low, but you know, anyway, I mean, it's incredible to see you and to see like how far you've come and you know, it's just amazing what this program has done for all of us, you know?
It really is crazy. Yeah. I think, you know, and I told you, I went to that 7 a.m. meeting every day. And then with my new job, I start at 6:30 in the morning, so I don't get to go to it every day. And, you know, for us, we don't like change, you know? Mm-hmm. We like, you know, the routine. And I, after maybe like the first week, I remember calling my sponsor, calling everybody like, I don't know how I'm going to do this job. Like, I don't have my medicine in the morning. I don't have this meeting, but it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now that I'm 3.5 years into recovery, like I don't go to as many meetings as I did, but I do other things to stay involved, you know, to stay involved in what got me here. And that's the people and that's the fellowship and that's staying connected. And that's feeling like I'm a part of something bigger than myself. And it's this amazing world.
And it ebbs and flows. I mean, I'm telling you, I've been through times of like not so many meetings and back to so many meetings, you know, and it's just like it ebbs and flows and it's okay. And and it's so funny because like recently I've been having these bad migraines and my boyfriend was like, do you think we'll ever get back to 100%? You know, because he wasn't feeling well. I wasn't feeling well. And I was like, I don't really think there's 100% anymore. I was like, I feel like it's this wave that I'm on. Yeah. And like, I'm just going to go with the flow. Like there's good days, there's bad days, but like I'm on it. I'm sticking to it. And you know, and it's okay. Like it's not the end of the world. I'm really lucky. Like I was at this... If we stay in gratitude, I mean, I was telling someone, like, just the fact, like, we take electricity for granted. We take Wi-Fi for granted. We take all these things for granted. And just, like, we're in, like, one of the best places to live. Even though some people don't believe that or know it. And thank you, don't come.
We have enough
people moving here. But it's, like, really amazing. And we're just so lucky.
Yeah.
So, okay. I do want to ask one question. So if you could go back in time and tell your younger self, you can choose the age, what would you tell your younger self?
Probably that you can do anything you put your mind to. I think that's it. Because like once I put my mind to staying sober and that was what I wanted to do, it became easy.
Yeah.
Easier. It became easier. But yeah, definitely... You can do anything you want to do.
I love that. That's awesome. Is there anything else you want to tell us?
Probably 1,000 things, but I can't think of them now.
Well, we'll have you back.
All right, cool.
Well, thank you so much for coming and let's hug it out.
Thank you for having me.